So I had a few things this week that stirred my mind to think about worship. There's a person who's hoping to visit here. They remarked that they were really looking forward to coming and they just wanted to worship with us. They had heard singing and they thought that was something that they'd be really blessed by, as being able to worship with other believers. And it got me wondering, do I have that proper motivation towards worship, the proper thinking of it? I know that whenever you're alone and then you come to a group, there's a great blessing in everyone being together and singing. And just thinking about, do I still have that desire in me? Do I have the proper heart and adoration towards God? And do I think about words that I'm singing? And worship is more than that, and we'll try to get into that. But another thing that came up this week was a brother that shared an inspiration that he had in the morning as he was reading about Jesus' temptation in the wilderness and how Satan had taken him up to see all the kingdoms of this world and offered that if he would just bow down and worship Satan, that he would be granted all of the power of the world over those kingdoms. And the inspiration the brother had was like, what kind of things do we do similar to that? The Satan set before us that if we turn our adoration towards any material things in our life and that rob us of that worship that we should have rightly towards God. And there's a range of that, whether it's just distractions that distract us from God to things that are, you know, possibly even more towards idolatry in the way that we give them our attention. Anyway, so this morning, then that led me to look at John chapter 4. And the passage is familiar enough with us that I won't take the time to read all of it. I mostly just want to focus on, so Jesus is talking with the Samaritan woman at the well, you know, there's the back and forth where he asks for water from her and explains to her that he has water to give of that would bring everlasting life and not a need for someone to be thirsty anymore. Then he has that prophetic message about her life. And then because of that, she says in verse 19, the Samaritan woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth." And that's the end of where I want to be looking at in that passage. So from the conversation there, the Samaritan, mentions this idea that there was a proper place of worship, that Jerusalem was the place to go to, that the Jews would have held that over others, that they had the proper location to come to the temple and offer sacrifices and that sort of thing. And Jesus acknowledges that the Jews had a more right understanding of some sort. He said, "We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." They had a better understanding of God. But he contrasts it and says, apparently, that neither the Jews nor the Samaritans were truly worshiping. He says that the hour is coming, and now is, that he's bringing here today, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, and the Father is seeking such to worship him. So I want to just think about that a little bit. What does it mean to worship God in spirit and truth? The first statement there, it's God is spirit, and that's why we must worship him in spirit. So God is not, what Jesus is pointing out here, I think, is that God is not not in bodily form. And so therefore, he doesn't need to be worshipped in a location, in Jerusalem or on this mountain or that mountain, or in that church building or that church building. He's not in a bodily form, and he also has no need of earthly things. And there's a lot of Old Testament scriptures, and I'll kind of just reference a few of them to refresh our mind. But he does not need the fat of rams or those kind of sacrifices. He doesn't need a house to dwell in, a physical house. In Isaiah 1, there's a long passage where Isaiah brings a rebuke to the people that were offering a lot of sacrifices and lifting up their voices and maybe even crying, or maybe I'm pulling from Malachi, but crying at the altar. But God did not desire these things. And it's in Isaiah 1, 11 to 12, 20. You can look at that. I'll just summarize that what God did want was them to learn to do good, to seek justice, to rebuke the oppressor, to defend the orphan and widow. He said, if you be willing and obedient, you will eat the good of the land. That was the thing that he was desiring in that. The Psalms speak a fair bit of this too. I want to just read a couple little snippets from Psalm 50. Psalm 50, verse 12-15. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine in all its fullness. Will I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Offer to God thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me. And then also at the end of that chapter, in verse 23, whoever offers praise glorifies me, and to him who orders his conduct aright, I will show the salvation of God. And then over in the penitent Psalm of David, after he sinned, he says in Psalm 51, I'll start in 14, deliver me from the guilt of bloodshed, O God, the God of my salvation, and my tongue shall sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall show forth your praise. For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. And in these passages, we see some kind of vain worship, like a worship that was not achieving anything that God wanted, and then it wasn't helping the people either. And this is like a really big topic, and I'm just trying to have a little opening here. But I thought of Matthew 15, where Jesus talks to the Pharisees about vain worship. He said that they were hypocrites, and in vain they were worshiping, teaching the commandments of men. So there's just an importance here. I'm just trying to bring together some of these concepts that we, in order to have true worship to God, he's looking for a broken spirit and a contrite heart. Like God is spirit, and so the word worship just has to do with prostrating yourself before, like bowing down before, and our spirits need to be doing that before God. And so that's what I think David's talking about, a broken spirit, a contrite heart, we're bowed humble before God. And that's a crucial part of worship. And then from these Psalms, we see that we offer praise and thanksgiving to God. And in that, there'd be a question that you might have if God is not in need of anything. Does God benefit from praise? Does God like praise? Or is some of that there'd be a way of thinking about worship that it's actually helpful for us. It's putting us in our proper place of bowing and being humble before God. But I think, as in any relationship, I think there's something that God does is inviting us to for that thanksgiving and praise, that it's an appropriate relationship with God. I guess I'm trying to point out there that like there would be this idea that God is just like wanting people to just adore him, like he's just it only makes sense in humans. Like you wouldn't it, there'd be something really improper for a human to desire all this praise and adoration. But I'm saying like in the context of worshiping God, it totally makes sense. It's proper for us and it's proper for God. Sorry, I got a little bit off track there. Hopefully that made sense. Okay, we need a broken spirit and a contrite heart. We need to offer praise and thanksgiving. And then we need to pattern our life after the life of Jesus, after righteousness before God, in our personal life, and then in a love toward our neighbor. There's the obvious verse on worship of Romans 12, where Paul says, I beseech you by the mercies of God to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. This might be a different Greek word because I know it's translated different ways, but says this is your reasonable, acceptable worship in some translations. Other translations say service, your appropriate service to God. So our bodies, as we humble ourselves and make our spirit bowed before God, then like the true sacrifice that God is looking for, the true worshiping God in spirit and in truth is where we're offering our life as a sacrifice to God. There'd be another concept that I think Jesus has in mind here with worshiping in spirit and truth is that in the Old Testament there was shadows, there was worshiping with shadows. That's what physical temple and a physical animal sacrifices, and that's what circumcision and feast days, all of that was worshiping God in shadow. And I think Jesus is saying there's a true worship that comes in the New Covenant. And so there's a couple New Testament passages that I'll just quickly close with that I think show that idea that we have something a bigger and better worship than what was in those bodily types and shadows. Paul in Philippians 3:3, we are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit. We rejoice in Christ Jesus and have no confidence in the flesh. And then he goes on to say how in the righteousness of the law, he would have had a lot to be confident in, but his confidence and his what his faith and trust is in is the righteousness that Jesus brought, dying and living in his life, in the new covenant. And then Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13, verse 9. I think he's talking here about being carried away with like bringing people back to the law of Moses. Do not be carried about with various and strange doctrines, for it is good that the heart be established by grace and not with foods which have not profited those who have been occupied with them. We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. For we here have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. Therefore, by him let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. But do not forget to do good and share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased. I think this passage does a really nice job of summing up some ideas there about what it means to worship God in spirit and truth. Just be an encouragement that we are willing to humble ourselves, to go out with Christ and suffer for the things that he suffered for. To be willing to carry that same cross and And in that we're worshiping God by offering up our praise, our thanks, and then the life of community, of sharing with one another. All those things are the true sacrifice and the worship that's pleasing to God. And there'd be just a whole lot of places you could go with worship. There's a lot in Revelation about worship, a lot more in the Psalms that could be gotten into. But anyway, that'd just be like a few verses to get our minds thinking in that way. So God bless you. If you have any thoughts or comments, corrections, feel free to share.
Thank you, Brother Daniel. It's a beautiful way to start out our service and thinking of the worship of God. And just two verses that I would say that you did very good. I can't add anything. I just would say, maybe someone else could, but one of the verses you didn't mention, of course, it doesn't say worship, would be when Moses was in the mountain, or come down from the mountain, and God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses. Moses said, the first commandment, which said, I am the Lord thy God that brought you out of the land of Egypt. Thou shouldn't make any graven images and serve them. And he says, for I am a jealous God. He's a jealous God. And he doesn't want us to bow down to many things, the world, the flesh, the devil, whatever the idol would be. And Deuteronomy does say also, God made his people for a peculiar treasure, for his own glory, a possession for his own glory, or something like that, a people for his own glory. So if we get that basics down, we can, and let us worship God together. That is, collective worship is beautiful, as the psalmist says, let us worship. But anyway, God is a jealous God, and let us praise his goodness and his severity too, for those who don't follow the Lamb. The Lord be magnified.
I'm sitting here wondering if I should share these thoughts or not. I don't want to confuse people as I try to share some of these underlying words of the English translations, but let me see how good a job I can do here. I don't know if you remember maybe some conversations years ago, maybe 5 years ago or something, maybe some folks would have with maybe Steve. Because I remember a contrast I've heard, even with Lady Matos down in Florida, you know, since she became Orthodox, I've heard the argument that they, Orthodox or Catholic apologists, make about, and I'm trying to remember the second word, but the first word they say is latreuo, is a Greek word that is usually understood to be some sort of worship in some sense, right? And I was just noticing that in Luke 4, one of the with the exchange that the three different temptations that Satan throws at Jesus, one of them was that word, and then I saw that, oh, well, over in Exodus in the Septuagint, the underlying Hebrew word is the word that in modern Greek they just consider the word as work. So there's a connection. And I just remember even my first semester of Hebrew in Jerusalem, that when I actually saw the first semester, that we were using this word in a sense of it being where priests were doing sacrifices. So there was some sort of connection between the idea of actually making sacrifices and that sort of priestly duty together with the idea of work. And of course, I immediately went to my thoughts about, oh, you're not saved by works in Romans chapter 3, the way we think of that. And I was like, oh, isn't that interesting? And but like I said, in modern Hebrew, it just means work. If you're going to your job, that's what it means in modern Hebrew. And so I saw, this exchange between Jesus and Satan, where that was one of the words they use. And then another word they use for worship predominantly, as Brother Daniel talked about, John chapter 4, verse 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, like he keeps using that word. And that underlying word is this word, if you look it up in the dictionary, the way it would look would be proskuneo. So that's usually translated as the idea of actually especially the idea of pros, which means towards, as a prefix on it, is the idea of bowing down. As I'm sitting there looking at underline, I was like, well, let me just see what kuneo, because I'm not really that familiar with that all by itself. And it's interesting, kind of the semantic range that that word has. That verb that they say it means to kiss, I don't know how precise that is, because that's typically not the word. Certainly when you're talking about the holy kiss, that's not the word to use. And so I was like, oh, let me look at some cognates that kind of share that root. And it shares the word, which I am familiar with, is the noun for dog, kuon. And it's like, oh, okay, so apparently because the dog is, you know, lapping up, you know, licking something or whatever, there's some sort of connection there. It's like, oh, isn't that interesting? Not to mention he's down on the ground, kind of the idea of bowing and stuff. And it's like, oh, and then there's some others that are kind of related to that idea. And it's like, oh, that's interesting. But so, yeah, proskuneo is the idea typically thought of where somebody bows down. And that was the other word that Satan used when he's talking to Jesus, and Jesus said, don't tempt the Lord your God, and so where he's telling him to, you know, yeah, just bow down to me and whatever. So I think the context there is pretty revealing, what he's is the, pretty much the way we understand it, to bow down and stuff. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Some sort of connection between the idea of working versus serving. Yeah, in fact, going back to latreo, there's a noun, latris, that is understood to be a servant that could be hired, you know, to do service. And yet, some of those cognates surrounding that word also was not just that, you know, service, work, but also being hired, but then also sometimes the same word could be used to be service to the gods. And of course, we're not talking about the true God. We're talking about this is a Greek perspective. So it's like, oh, that's interesting too. So anyway, I just thought I would share those thoughts.
Yeah, I appreciated the opening and the things you shared there. I just had some thoughts, and maybe it's more of questions about in Hebrews 13 here, where you read, do not be carried away with various and strange doctrines. Just came to my mind, like, wouldn't it be nice if you'd been a little more specific about the various and strange doctrines that he was encouraging people not to be carried away with. Like if he'd have said, like this and this and this. But I think he's, if I look at it I think the thought kind of starts, maybe it doesn't exactly start, but it starts in verse 7 there, I think, a little bit at least. Remember those who rule over you, who have spoken the word of God to you, whose faith follow, considering the outcome of their conduct. At last, considering the outcome of their conduct is what I was thinking about. And then if you go back down, then it says Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So he's kind of giving the idea of something that's stable, and like something that's like Jesus is not different one day and then different the next, like not this erratic thing. Do not be carried about with various and strange doctrines. I think if we tend to be carried about with various and strange doctrines, we will be kind of erratic all over the place. First one way and then another, and up and down and back and forth. And it says it's good to be, for the heart be established by grace. Like, I could think like, well, what does that mean? Like, and I don't really know that. I guess I have an idea of what it means, but it's hard to put it in. It's hard to explain, like, what does it mean to be established by grace? And he says, not with foods which have not profited those who have been occupied with them. I guess I wonder if anybody has thoughts. I guess I think he's not talking about literal food necessarily, but about things that people were occupying themselves with that they weren't profited by. And it was obvious, it would be evident that they were occupying themselves with things, various strange doctrines that they weren't profited by. So I guess the thought I had there was just that it'd be nice to have more specifics, like what Paul was talking about, but maybe it's just good that we don't, and that maybe it kind of all points back to just by their fruits you will know them, like by someone's conduct, and you'll be able to know. I guess know people that whose heart has been established by grace.
This subject kind of made me think about that famous question: why does God allow for suffering to occur in a man's life, or makes me think to draw him closer to him. And even if a man is of faith, it doesn't mean that God doesn't challenge or test him in different ways to bring him closer. And I guess I kind of think about Job. And even though Job was a man of faith, like his world was rocked to the ground, and anyways, that story made me think, it's like Job thought he was completely justified in everything that he was doing, and yet God still had a form of correction for him. There was something for him to focus on, something to pay attention to, and I just think, like, okay, so if we in this world need to suffer a little bit in order to be able to see the things that God really wants us to see, whether it be in our character or things we need to pay attention to, then suffering is fairly important. And then I think, like, okay, so what if the world was perfect? What if the world was exactly as it should have been, designed by God, and everything went exactly as according to plan and should be, but then everybody forgot about God. They thought about, you know, everything went exactly as it should, and nobody suffered. It's like, what if people just forgot to give thanks for the things that God gave them? It's like, what would that look like?
Hey, Brother Norman, here's some thoughts here. So looking at this verse in Hebrews chapter 13, maybe give a little more precision to better understanding, maybe verse 9. So yeah, they translate it, like you said, the whole idea of being strengthened or established by grace is the translation you have. So yeah, the verb there that they're like translating as strengthened has to do with certainty. Like there'd be like a greater certainty, which obviously points back to the idea of faith, because I don't even like the word faith because it's so ambiguous. I like the word trust. It really has to do with trust. So trusting God is what faith really is, right? So there to be a greater certainty of that trust, I think, is what it's saying. And I, you know, keep trying to remind you guys, the word that the translators, they look at this word charis, and they're like, well, you know, it can mean thanks or gratitude, or it can mean, you know, this word grace or kindness, really. So kindness or gratitude, just remind yourself when you see that word, you're like, well, does it fit better in the context? Or is it actually maybe both? I would argue it's both here. So being strengthened by charis is like the gratitude that we would have versus the kindness that God shows to us. So it's kind of like a double-sided coin there, I think. It makes sense to me that it's good. It says because it's good that we would be made more certain by kindness of God or by our gratitude towards God, the heart, it says, so that the heart would be made more certain, established, strengthened, I guess they translate that way. But yeah, it literally has to do with certainty. So yeah, I think all these thoughts kind of fit in that area, yeah. Again, admittedly, there's the things of what it says versus in the totality of what we know the message is in the whole New Testament. A lot of times it can point us to things to where, isn't it implying this, like Brother Rob is suggesting? And it seems like, yeah, but is it, it's like, okay, this is what it says versus what does it imply is the second stage to go to. And I think, yeah, it implies all these things. So our... But the idea of just being sure, certain, is, you know, when they say strengthen or establish, that's literally what it means. Sure. I mean, when you take out insurance, right, it's about something that you can have confidence and certain. If this happens, then this is sure that, you know, something happens to me, my wife is going to get this money so that she'll be fine. Or like sure and certain, you know, so to be made more certain by charis, by gratitude or thanks towards God. I would seem to imply the gratitude or kindness, which they use the word grace. So, but yeah.
I don't really like talking after having already talked in a message, but the reason that I think that the author of Hebrews is talking about Jewish law is that it's the main focus of the whole letter, the whole book. This would just be like a little example. A couple chapters back in chapter 9, he says, it was symbolic for the present time in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to the conscience. Concerned only with foods and drinks, various washings, fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. So I guess my thought would be that if you focus on the Old Covenant rituals like that, you would be focusing on foods and drinks and washings. And it says here that cannot make the person offering it perfect. And so then the argument is that the New Covenant can, and that's where our focus should be. So don't be carried about with the strange doctrines. All the things that the Jewish people could be trying to pull people back into. And then I guess my thought would be that grace is a stand-in word that means Jesus and the covenant that he brings. I think throughout all of Paul's letters, and if this was written by Paul, then we could see it the same way. But either way, I think grace, you'll see it stand in as the whole new covenant concepts.
Thank you. Produce their fruit for years.